Readers, welcome to the holiday edition of the Book Report. These days have flown by, and here we are, with Christmas just days ahead. As Edna Ferber once said, Christmas isn't a season, it's a feeling. It's a feeling we wish we could keep with us. Today's show is a festive mix of holiday-themed fiction and two warm, wonderful books by my guests, Gail Sheehy and Dr. Brian Weiss. And if by chance you've not yet found that perfect gick, you're in the Saint Nick of time. BookReportRadio.com is chock full of ideas for everyone on your list. Happily, our holiday tradition continues, and we have a special guest who'll drop by to retell Twas the Night Before Christmas. So, with me in my kerchief and you in your cap, let's settle into page one of the holiday edition of the Book Report. A Christmas Escape is Anne Perry's 12th Noel to the season. Lonely Charles Latterly, a character from Perry's popular William Monk series, arrives at his small island hotel, hoping the blue skies will brighten his spirits. Unfortunately, there's no holiday cheer to be found among his fellow guests, who include a pompous novelist, a stuffy colonel, a dangerously ill-matched married couple, and an ailing old man. The one charming exception is orphan teenager Candace Finbar, who takes Charles under her wing and introduces him to the island's beauty. But the tranquility of the holiday is swiftly disrupted by a violent quarrel, an unpleasant gentleman's shocking claims of being stalked, and the ominous stirrings of the local volcano. Then, events take a darker turn. A body is found, and Charles quickly realizes the killer must be among the group of guests. Stephen Crossley performs the book.
Anxiety flickered across her face. Where's Uncle Roger?
His legs were a little tired, Charles replied, trying not to sound breathless. He hoped you wouldn't mind if he went back. I promised I would see that you got down again safely.
He's all right, she pressed.
Yes, it's just a long way. Perhaps he shouldn't have concealed his lack of breath. And getting steeper as we go up. I dare say the air's a little thinner too.
She regarded him more closely. Are you all right?
Good heavens, did she put him in the same bracket of age and corresponding frailty as Roger Finbar?
Or are you trying to make me feel all right about Uncle Roger? She went on.
To say she was frank would be an understatement. The latter, Charles replied a little tartly. He would be very unhappy with me if I allowed you to be worried.
She looked taken aback, for once uncertain how to accept the remark.
He noticed it with some satisfaction. In fact, he smiled back at her, meeting her eyes with something of a challenge. She understood immediately.
All right, let's go on up.
They climbed in silence for quite a distance, Candace always a few steps ahead of him. He appreciated that. It allowed him to see her all the time and know that while she was pushing herself, she was well within her strength. It also meant that if he was weary and had to grit his teeth to force himself on now and then, she didn't know it. He realized now that he had been far too sedentary, not getting nearly enough exercise. It wasn't good for him. He was soft, weak, where he should be strong. If this break over Christmas did nothing else for him, it would at least make him take more care of his health. The next time they stopped, his legs were aching, and he was glad to see that Candace also seemed a little out of breath. Her cheeks were flushed and she was drawing in lungs full of the thin, slightly acrid air, but she was smiling broadly, not just with victory, but with the pure joy of adventure. He looked around. They were standing on rock and cinder now, and there was no vegetation at all. Underfoot was all dust and solidified lava, and it was warm to the touch. Was that a slight tremor, or did he imagine it?
"This is far enough," he said firmly.
"It's all right," she said with a meekness he had not expected. "I can feel it."
"A shake?" he asked with surprise. "I wasn't certain if I'd imagined it."
"Not really a shake," she shook her head. "But it's uneasy, isn't it? As if it's asleep but having bad dreams." He could not have put it better.
"You speak as if it were alive."
He said it lightly, as if it amused him, but her word uneasy was exactly the one he would have used. Ridiculous, really. It was rock. "Can you feel it?" She turned to look at him. "Through your feet. It's alive. It's the earth. The heart of it. We see only the skin on the very outside, like a fungus."
"Delightful," he said sarcastically. "I hadn't thought of myself as a skin disease."
"Of course you hadn't. You're not a volcano." She smiled at him as if that were a perfectly reasonable point of view. He took a step toward her, just in case she defied him and decided to go closer to the edge, perhaps even to look down into the burning heart of the mountain. Was it red? He wondered. Was it molten rock down far below them, seething and boiling where they could actually see it? He was seized with a desire to know. How amazing to have stood this close to such a thing and never to know for certain. Perhaps he could see the naked heart of the earth, not covered over with a mantle of rock.
We've just heard A Christmas Escape by Anne Perry. A world-renowned author, journalist, and lecturer, Gail Sheehy has changed the way women and men look at the stages of their lives. The Library of Congress named her revolutionary book, Passages, published in 1976, as one of the 10 most influential books of our times. Gail has written 17 books in all. 5 of these revisit the passage theme and explore the stages of adult life. In her work as a journalist, Gail has covered national and world leaders and broken many cultural taboos. She culminated a decade of following Hillary Clinton for Vanity Fair with the biography Hillary's Choice. She's written about the character and psychology of presidential candidates from Robert Kennedy to Barack Obama and world leaders from Margaret Thatcher to Saddam Hussein. Passing 70, Gail figured it was time to turn the lens on herself. She's written a memoir about her own passages. The book is called Daring, My Passages, and we're honored to speak with her about it today. Welcome, Gail. I'm thrilled to have you with us on the Book Report. It seems you knew your destiny from seventh grade on when you stole into Manhattan from the suburbs on Saturday mornings to observe and to write. Tell us about that.
Well, my grandmother and I used to listen to a radio show called Grand Central Station, and it was so exciting, and it talked about the crossroads of a million private lives. And I thought, I've got to get there. I mean, the suburbs doesn't have anything to write about. So I would sneak onto the train, or tell the ticket taker that I was going in for my tap dancing lessons, and I was a little tiny person, and I would just get to the end, and I'd climb up the steps to the balcony around the huge center and look at the crossroads of a million private lives, and I'd see a man in a slouched hat meet with a woman who had on dark glasses, and they would exchange words and then move apart, and I think, they must be communists. That was the height of the McCarthy hearing. So I had something to write about. I would scribble it on my little pad and go home and use the typewriter my grandmother bought me when I was 8 years old to write a story.
Were you on the school newspapers?
Yes, I was, the high school. And in college, I was more interested in acting, which ultimately stood me in good stead because my latest book, a memoir called Daring, is really about how to dream dangerously and act confidently. And learning how to act is very helpful for women because we don't feel as confident as men do. And you have to put on a confident face. That's what gets people excited about what you have to offer.
As is your writing style, you interview extensively before writing about your subject. You interviewed friends and colleagues before writing your memoir, Daring. What was that like for you?
Well, it was wonderful to go back to, you know, good times, even bad times, and sometimes discover they weren't as bad as I thought they were. But I also had diaries, or daytimers, as they were called, calendars that I'd been keeping since the 1970s. And often, being a writer, I would write on the side page a little dialogue, a little sketch of scene. So I had that to remember. Otherwise, I'm sure I wouldn't have been able to write it.
You wrote Gloria Steinem was the sister everybody would have loved to have. How so?
Gloria was always about helping other people and being a colleague. She used to travel in her early years always with an African-American woman to show that this was not, the women's movement was not in contradiction to the civil rights movement. It was actually just another aspect of it. And Gloria had taken care of her mother when she was a young girl, wasn't able even to go full-time school until she was 10 years old. And so she never wanted to marry because she didn't want to have to take care of a man. But she always had very close women friends.
I loved reading about Tom Wolfe's 1970 article, Radical Chic, chronicling the party at Leonard Bernstein's Park Avenue penthouse, where the Black Panthers were celebrated by Jason Robards, Stephen Sondheim, Mike Nichols, among others. It was, as you say, the first commentary on political correctness. What are your thoughts now on our country's slavish adherence to political correctness?
I think it's such a deterioration of our language, of our sense of freedom of speech. I certainly think that some people go too far, namely Donald Trump, using it to be beastie about other people, to demonize the other, so many others. Now it's Syrian refugees, before it was Mexicans. But I think that political correctness gets in the way of exactly what language is meant to do, which is meant to connect us with each other and help us to be empathetic to other people. And if we don't state the problem, we can't really talk about the solution if we are disturbed by people who are different than we are.
Let's talk about Passages, the book that took you 3 years to write and, you say, 37 years to live. How did the idea for that book come to you?
Well, it was a traumatic experience I had in Northern Ireland, where I was not expecting to be in the middle of Bloody Sunday, but suddenly I was, and a boy right next to me was shot in the face, and I was only 32 years old. I thought everything could be mended when I was that young, and it was too late to help him. People piled in us. We were like a caterpillar crawling up on an outdoor staircase to get into someplace safe, because the British Army was spraying the unarmed crowd with automatic rifle fire. It was one of the first of what has become the norm now in conflict zones. And when I came back to New York from that trauma, it took me 6 months for it to catch up with me. And then I began, some kind of inner voice began asking me questions that I found difficult to answer. You know, the arithmetic of life suddenly came to me. Half my life had already been spent. What, you know, didn't I want another child and another marriage since my first had ended? And then it would ask me again, well, is it enough to be writing magazine articles? What about, and books? What about doing something in the world? So I began looking at interviews that I had already done with couples in crisis, intending to write that book. And I began to see that among those 35 to 45, they were younger then, we've moved on since then, I had evidence of disequilibrium, the same kind of disappointment with where we'd been, even though it might have been the right place, a sense of time running out, a sense of urgency. And I came to call it, ultimately, midlife crisis. Nobody had used that term. And then I began to see that there were other predictable passages, as I came to call it, and that if we knew about them and knew that they were normal, we would be much better able to take advantage of them and stretch and grow, because that's how you grow, by changing. And so I wrote the book thinking it would sink without a trace because I didn't have a degree as a psychologist. And the first review was by a very jealous man who was an editor at Time magazine. And so he wrote an unkind review, and I thought, well, that's it. It's over. And then people began to react to the book. And it was very interesting. The people brought the reviewers around. Then suddenly the reviews became glowing, and it was off to the races.
We are speaking with Gail Sheehy on the Book Report.
How would you counsel the baby boomer population who are heading into their 60s and beyond? What is their passage? How to improve their passage?
Well, I think the biggest passage for boomers who are now almost mid-50s and already moving into their 70s is to really think about how to give back. That is the main issue. What is really important at that time of life when time is short? And I find that in most people, there is an urgency about making a difference, helping in whatever way you can to leave your little corner of the world a little better place. And most people are doing it. And that's one of the reasons that boomers are working longer and moving on to nonprofits or starting nonprofits so that they can make more of a difference. And I find that very encouraging. I actually have come up with a new phase. I call it the surge 60s. So many women in particular really surge in their 60s. They're totally free of responsibilities for other people. Their kids don't want to hear about what they should do. Their husbands are maybe retired, or maybe they don't, maybe they've passed on. And they really have, you know, nothing much to lose by getting out there and saying what they truly believe in and trying to persuade other people to take their path.
Did having Margaret Mead as your professor impact your writing of passages?
Enormously. Dr. Mead told me, as a journalist, what I needed to do was whenever there was a major event, an assassination, an attack. We hadn't had terrorist attacks, but she would have said that about Ferguson. Drop everything. Get on a bus or a train or a plane. Get there. Stand at the edge of the abyss. Look down, and you will see your culture turn inside out.
Anyone who reads Daring has to be insanely jealous of the people you've met along the way, the friends that you've made. Will you share a memory from your newsroom days?
From my newsroom?
Mm-hmm.
The first friend I made that who became my mentor and later my husband was Clay Felker. I was sequestered in the women's department of the New York Herald Tribune on the fourth floor, not allowed to cross into the testosterone zone, the newsroom, in the late 1960s. That's where women had to stay. But I snuck down the back stairs so my editor wouldn't catch me to pitch a story to Clay Felker. I was scared to death. And he looked up and he said, "Where did you come from?" And I said, "The estrogen zone." Well, that connected with him. And he said, "Come on in. What do you got for me?" And so I had 10 seconds to pitch a story. And I pitched this crazy story. And he said, "Great. We'll run it as, we'll call it the Flypaper People. Just write it like you told it to me. Write it as a scene." Well, write journalism as a scene? I mean, up to then, journalism had been who, what, when, where, why, very dry. And he was asking me to jump off, take a leap into a new kind of writing, which became known as the new journalism. So I was so fortunate to get in on the ground floor, along with Tom Wolfe and Jimmy Breslin and lots of other wonderful writers.
You've written extensively about Hillary Clinton. What are your thoughts about her current presidential campaign?
Hillary Clinton never ceases to fascinate me. I wrote a biography of her. I covered her for 10 years for the Vanity Fair. And I find now that there is some ambivalence around Hillary, particularly by her own peers. The age group in their early 50s to 70, they are less enthusiastic about her than women 18 to 45. So it's wonderful that she's getting younger women, but it's telling that the older women have problems that they can hardly articulate about her. And she's got to win them over because they will be one-fifth of the voters in 2016 will be boomer women. One-fifth.
Well, Gail, I loved the book. I encourage everyone to go out, read it. It's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Elaine. Thank you, Elaine. Thank you.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Daring, My Passages, a memoir performed by Bernadette Dunn.
I desperately needed a job. I paid no attention when I began upchucking in the morning. It must be the summer heat. But when I felt a faint flutter in my belly, a tickle of life, I was ecstatic. Guess what? I jumped up and down on the pull-down bed when Albert came home. We're pregnant. He danced with me on the bed. It broke. Since he was never home long enough to repair it, I slept in a V position inches off the tile floor. Sitting before the stained glass window doors in the sweltering heat of August, I bent over my Singer to sew a maternity dress. I didn't know how long I could hold out before I'd have to take a waitressing job, but I knew there was only one place I wanted to work, the Trib. Still no reply from Eugenia. An interview with the city editor at the World Telegram and Sun started out poorly. He skimmed my clips. What makes you think a little girl like you from the boonies of Rochester can write for a big city daily? I didn't know geography was the measure of talent. I like the way you talk, sister. He hired me on the spot. During my first week of working on the Telegram's women's page in August 1963, I kept hearing about an impending protest march on Washington. The country was on high alert. Images from the vicious response of Birmingham's police to a peaceful protest led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Freedom Riders, seeing fire hoses and dogs turned on terrified high school students, burned in memory. Medgar Evers had just been assassinated only weeks before. My reportorial juices were inflamed. The march was going to be a historic confrontation. Despite dire warnings of certain violence by the government, President Kennedy was supporting Dr. King. I knew the Washington Mall would be crammed with brave black women and men. I would persuade the editor to send me. But when I told Albert my idea, he hit the roof. You're pregnant. Are you crazy? They're going to tear gas people. I had to admit, he was right. We watched the march on TV. When I saw, I ached to be there. I was electrified by Dr. King's speech, envisioning a day when children, regardless of their race, would be judged by their character. Seeing the mall dense with the humanity of many colors, I heard not a sound of violence, only silence, rapt silence. I thought about the future of the child growing within me. It was 100 years after Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, and freedom still had not been given. It had to be won. I vowed I would not spend my life watching the news on TV. I would dare to be there as history happened and write what I saw. At the end of August 1963, I was invited to interview with Eugenia Shepherd, a miniature woman perched on piano legs, but a force majeure. I flattered her with my archival knowledge of her columns. She wanted me as a feature writer. Thank God I would never again have to fake passion in print for the latest collection of Junior League tea dresses when all I wanted to do was plunge into the subcultures of New York. I offered 3 weeks' notice to the editor who had hired me at the World Telegram. Not surprisingly, his face screwed into a bug-eyed facsimile of a jilted lover. The World Telegram will not be used as a stepping stone for that paper. Clear out your desk and leave. Walking out of the paper's downtown offices into the hammering heat of late summer, I was giddy with anticipation. But what would I wear to pass muster with Eugenia when I had a telltale bulge? I had been told there were two things she found abhorrent, pregnancy and old age. I spent the next couple of days sewing an orange and purple striped knockoff of a Marimekko tent dress that a pregnant Jacqueline Kennedy had worn in the 1960 U.S. presidential campaign.
We've just heard Daring, My Passages by Gail Sheehy. Christmas Bells by Jennifer Chavarini celebrates Christmas past and present with a novel inspired by Longfellow's classic poem, I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day, Their Old Familiar Carols Play, and wild and sweet, the words repeat, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. In 1860, the Longfellow family celebrated Christmas at their home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The publication of Longfellow's classic Revolutionary War poem, Paul Revere's Ride, was less than a month hence, and the country's political unrest weighed heavily on his mind. Yet, with his beloved wife Fanny and their five children at his side, the delights of the season prevailed. The parallel story takes place in present-day Boston, where a dedicated teacher in the Watertown public school system is stunned by somber holiday tidings. Sophia's music program has been sacrificed to budget cuts. She worries not only about her impending unemployment, but about the consequences to her underprivileged students. At the church where she volunteers as music director, Sophia tries to forget her cares as she leads the children's choir in rehearsal for their Christmas Eve concert. Inspired to honor a local artist, Sophia has chosen a carol set to a poem by Longfellow, moved by the glorious words he penned one Christmas day long ago. You'll be delighted by the intertwining stories and how they infuse us with the wonder of the season. Christina Moore performs the book.
Yet even as the gospel reading told the story of the birth of the Prince of Peace, Henry had overheard murmurs in the pews, troubling reports from South Carolina. After the service, as the worshippers filed from the church, conversations quickly turned from the exchange of holiday greetings to the rising enmity between North and South. The slave states had been threatening to leave the Union for more than 40 years, but ever since Abraham Lincoln had won the presidential election in early November, tensions had soared, and calls for secession in the Southern press had become even more frenzied and furious. Equally troubling, foreboding letters from Henry's closest friend, Charles Sumner, the senior senator from Massachusetts, told of rising animosity within both chambers of Congress. Henry trusted Sumner's judgment, for purely as a matter of self-preservation, his friend had become a careful observer of the temper of the Senate. More than 4 years earlier, Sumner had been beaten nearly to death in the Senate chamber by Representative Preston Brooks of South Carolina, who had taken great offense to one of Sumner's more vitriolic speeches condemning slavery. Sumner's head trauma and psychic wounds had been so severe that he had not resumed his Senate duties for 3 years. Through the post, Henry and Sumner debated the likelihood that South Carolina would make good on her threats and leave the Union. What I am afraid of, Henry confided to his friend, is not that they will go, but that the North will yield. The tone of the Boston papers, the Atlas only excepted, is very weak and spiritless. In conversations with his wife, his dear, beloved Fanny, Henry tried to be more optimistic. Nothing will come of this bluster and outrage, he had assured her only a few weeks before Christmas. The Southern firebrands will settle down after Mr. Lincoln's inauguration, just as they always have. Do you really think so? Asked Fanny, her large, dark eyes full of worry and doubt. Their anger seems different this time. The Southern aristocrats seem inflamed by a particular hatred for Mr. Lincoln, and a desperate fear that he'll take away their slaves with a stroke of a pen on his first day in office. If only it were that easy, said Henry ruefully. Even with Mr. Lincoln as president, I believe the abolition of slavery will take time, and it'll come only after the usual squabbling and deal-making in Washington City. Then you don't believe war is inevitable? No, my dearest, I don't. Not war and not secession. He smiled and kissed her. I'll believe that South Carolina truly intends to leave the Union when she leaves it, and not before. Fanny had seemed reassured, and Henry, too, had allowed himself to hope, but then, only a few days before Christmas, at a state convention at St. Andrew's Hall in Charleston, the delegates of South Carolina had voted unanimously to secede from the Union. The stock market roiled, politicians debated what to do, and citizens north and south wondered, some in trepidation, others eagerly, Which states would follow South Carolina into rebellion? With the Christmas bells ringing joyfully and his beloved Fanny on his arm, smiling warmly up at him from beneath the blue woolen hood of her cloak, it seemed to Henry almost unfathomable that anywhere thoughts could be troubled or hearts twisted in anger. He patted Fanny's hand where it rested in the crook of his elbow and felt a familiar surge of wonder and happiness when she squeezed his arm tenderly and briefly rested her cheek against his shoulder. For all his poetical gifts, he could scarcely put into words what an inexpressible delight Fanny was to him, always and in all things. Although they had been married more than 17 years, he still never caught a glimpse of her without a thrill of pleasure. She never entered a room where he was without his heart quickening, nor departed without feeling that some of the light went with her. Henry and Fanny had first met more than 24 years before, not in Boston, though they lived but 5 miles from each other, but while traveling in the Bernese Alps. Henry, alone and grieving the recent loss of his first wife in childbirth, Fanny on a European tour with her father, elder brother, sister, and cousin. At 19, Frances Appleton had known her own share of heartbreak and knew more yet awaited her.
That was a sampling of Christmas Bells by Jennifer Chavarini. Brian Weiss is a graduate of Columbia University and Yale Medical School and founding chairman and chairman emeritus of the Department of Psychiatry at the Mount Sinai Medical Center in Miami. He is America's leading authority in past life regression therapy. His background and extensive experience in traditional psychotherapy was set on a new course more than a decade ago when one of his patients began recalling past life traumas that seemed to hold the key to her recurring nightmares and anxiety attacks. Astonished and initially skeptical, Weiss's skepticism eroded when his patient began to channel messages from The Space Between Lives that contained remarkable revelations about Weiss's family and his dead son. Realizing that past life regression therapy presented potential as a powerful new therapeutic method, Weiss went on to cure the patient and embark on a new, more meaningful phase of his own career. Weiss has authored 9 books, including the best-selling Many Lives, Many Masters, in which he vividly describes the insights of a young patient named Catherine, who came to important realizations about the circumstances of her life today and the intricate thread of previous beings with her experience. Dr. Weiss has been featured in numerous magazines, newspapers, and TV shows, including Oprah Winfrey, Larry King Live, 2020, 48 Hours, and on the Discovery Channel and CNN. Today, Dr. Weiss drops by the program to speak about his new book, Miracles Happen, which documents experiences of workshop participants and how understanding our past lives can dramatically improve the present. Welcome, Dr. Weiss. It's a pleasure to have you with us on the Book Report.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here with you.
As a traditionally trained academic, how difficult was it for you to first believe in a spiritual universe in past lives?
It was very difficult for me. I was, as you mentioned, trained in a very left-brain way, medical school, psychiatry, very formal. Then I had a patient who started remembering past lives. She did not believe in it, neither did I. But then as she continued to have memories, her symptoms disappeared. She was knowing facts and details that she had no knowledge of consciously, and able to give me information that was very private, too. And so with all of these things, and this was in 1980, so 35 years ago, she started believing in the past lives before I did, because she had the direct experience. And mine was kind of observing her and watching it. But when she was able to bring this information about my father and son, both of whom had died, and she knew very specific details, that was the epiphany for me. It was very difficult, though, being so left-brained.
Yes, of course. In preparing for this interview, I spoke with a friend's son who had just completed his studies in psychiatry. I asked him about what he had learned, and I asked him specifically if his teachers ever spoke about this kind of regression. And he said, no, not at all. He was never exposed to it. What inroads do you believe have been made with your colleagues who resist this practice?
It's the field of psychiatry and psychiatrists. That's the most difficult nut to crack. Yeah. Others are coming over, priests, the church, other kinds of physicians and therapists. And so the psychiatrists, because it isn't taught, and they really don't know what it is. I was never exposed to that either. But now, as I meet a chairman of a psychiatry department who may be open-minded, and I get invited to do grand rounds or these kinds of presentations in medical schools, we have little islands of understanding. So, and this is in the United States, because in Japan, in India, I've spoken in both of those countries, and academically it's more accepted, and most Latin American countries too.
How would you describe this new book, Miracles Happen, as evolved from earlier works?
Well, Many Lives, Many Masters, my first book, and that's still the most well-known. That talks about my story and how this patient changed my life and her life changed. This book is actually the ninth, and it's the sixth major book. So this one is really an accumulation of people who had experiences at workshops that I teach at and train others to do this work. So they're not just patients now, but people who may come to a five-day professional training where I train all sorts of therapists to do past life therapy and go back to their states or countries and practice it there. So I'm like a farmer. I'm fertilizing, seeding, and they're the plants that are growing. And so they've all had some profound experiences. And my daughter Amy and I accumulated 70 or 80 of the most interesting. And then I commented on each one, where it fits in, about past lives. Because not only is past life therapy interesting from a spiritual perspective and about grief and life after death, but also people are able to get rid of symptoms, clinical symptoms, psychological symptoms, physical symptoms as they remember past lives, even if they don't believe in it. For example, I had a radiologist patient, and he was suffering from severe back pain. He had to take medicine, which he hated to take. It made him drowsy, difficulty concentration. And so he came in to see me early in my career doing this, and we found he had died in a Middle Ages battle, lanced in the back. Just in that spot where his pain was. Now, that doesn't prove it. We have a lot of evidential cases, but this is not. It's too long ago. But his pain disappeared. It's never come back. And he had been to orthopedic surgeons and chiropractic physicians and others with no help at all.
I loved one of the statements in your book, we are all born with a form of PTSD, but the stress comes from a past life.
Right. That's what we find. Traumas from a past life, they're often causing symptoms in this life, like the radiologist or someone who fell off a castle wall in the 12th century. Now they have a fear of heights, or we've all drowned or had other traumas in past lives. And then when I can link that up to clinical conditions, for example, many people with asthma have died of suffocation or smoke inhalation or asphyxiation in past lives. Whether you can validate that or not, the asthma gets better.
Have you discovered some of your past lives?
Yes, I have, because I wanted to know what my patients were going through. And so eventually I had some of my own. One was as a Catholic priest during the Inquisition time in Scotland, and I was tortured and killed for teaching forbidden subjects. So in a way, I'm still doing that. The secular priest, psychiatrist, and I don't think I'll be tortured and killed for it this time around, but here I am knocking on that wall again.
We're speaking with Dr. Brian Weiss on The Book Report. You wrote, sometimes an advanced soul will volunteer to incarnate in a physical body in order to teach us important lessons. Does this kind of extreme self-sacrifice move you up the karmic chain?
Yes. Sometimes, as I said, a really advanced soul will come back here to give other people an opportunity to grow and advance themselves. That's what advanced souls, or in Eastern religions it's called bodhisattva, that kind of energy, helping out. And yes, because love has to be balanced. If nobody were to receive love, who could give it? So sometimes that soul will volunteer to be disabled in one way or another so that other people can learn to express their love, to be compassionate. These are higher order lessons. And this angelic or higher level soul comes to help others learn their lessons. In the end, we all live many, many times. We're not our bodies, but the spiritual essence or soul that goes from body to body. So when you look at it like that, a short life, a difficult life, it's not the end of our soul's evolution or development. We come back again and again, often being reunited with our loved ones because they're in the same kind of cycle. And that's how we learn here. We have to learn that we're all the same so that our souls, it's like having a car and the soul as a driver. When the car wears out, we get another car, maybe a different color, different type from a different country, manufacturer. That's what it's like. So if you hate a particular group of people, you have to learn that we're all the same. We're incarnating in all these different groups. We have to learn from all sides, male, female, rich, poor, white, yellow, black, red, whatever color, because the soul doesn't have those characteristics. And so that's why we shouldn't hate, we shouldn't be prejudiced, we should not be violent. The world will be a much better place.
Can you explain about souls and masks?
Well, I think that in terms of the body, that's the mask that I talk about. The soul, and there's a famous quote from Teilhard de Chardin, a Christian mystic of around 1800. He said, "We are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience." And I love that because it really captures the nuance of the whole thing. We're spiritual beings. We're having this human experience, but we'll have many human experiences. So the mask is our body, our personas, our personalities, all these external things. The soul, that deeper consciousness, the deeper mind, that's who we really are. But we've forgotten this, and we have to remember. And at the end of the life, we discard the masks. We don't need them anymore. And then we take on a new mask when we come back into physical form.
So any final thoughts about your wonderful book?
Oh, no, I'm so grateful that people have taken to that book, especially the first book, Many Lives, Many Masters. It's in 40 languages, more or less, and all over the world. And I never expected that. I thought it would die under the W's at the bottom of a bookshelf somewhere. That's what I really expected, but it didn't. And I'm very, very grateful to the universe and all the readers for making this possible. And thank you, too, for this interview, because this is teaching to me. It's really about teaching and for me, and through radio, through television, and in other ways. This is how teaching is done these days and reaches so many people. So grateful to you, too.
Well, I'm very grateful that you found the time to talk to us today. Thank you so much, Dr. Weiss.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And now, let's preview Miracles Happen, narrated by Kevin Foley.
"There are big waves knocking down trees," she whispered in a hoarse voice as she described an ancient scene. "There's no place to run. It's cold. The water is cold. I have to save my baby, but I cannot. Just have to hold her tight. I drown. The water chokes me. I can't breathe, can't swallow. Salty water. My baby is torn out of my arms." Her body had tensed, her breathing accelerated. Suddenly, her body and her breathing relaxed completely. "I see a cloud. My baby is with me, and others from my village. I see my brother." My skepticism needed more time to erode, but the process had begun. Catherine's severe symptoms began to disappear as she remembered more scenes from this and other prior lifetimes. I knew that imagination could not dissolve such chronic symptoms. Only actual memories could. Catherine would go on to remember many historical facts and details from her past lives, which we were sometimes able to confirm. She was also able to relate private truths from my own life, truths that she had no obvious way of knowing or discovering. She would tell me these personal facts while she floated in that beautifully relaxed state in between physical lifetimes. Those powerful evidential encounters with Catherine began to open my mind and to erase my doubts. I found other reputable clinicians conducting regressions and research, and I became further convinced. Ever since Many Lives, Many Masters, my first book, was published in 1988, I have treated over 4,000 individual patients using past life regression therapy, and many, many more in large groups during my experiential workshops. Each case validates and confirms, teaches and expands. Each case reveals more of life's mystery. In that time, I've met with past life pioneers and luminaries from all over the world. Where there was once disbelief, there is now carefully collected knowledge and wisdom. The stories in this book will propel you on the very same path and lead you from doubt to discovery. Just open your own mind and let this miraculous journey begin. In the workshops that I conduct, approximately 2/3 of the audience successfully remembers episodes from previous lives. Their memories and recollections frequently heal emotional and physical maladies. Symptoms resolve even though the memory may not be absolutely accurate, for an error in recall does not negate the truth and importance of the memory. As an example, in a regression, you may recall the trauma, chaos, and even the entire emotional reaction of your mother when you were 3 years old and ran into the street, almost getting hit by a black Buick. When you check with your mother, it turns out that the car was a navy blue Cadillac. Otherwise, everything else in your recall was accurate. This slight degree of distortion is acceptable. Memory is not literal time travel. And if, in describing the memory of the near accident, you used a word that you did not learn until you were 12, this is also fine. Your observing and describing mind is your present-day consciousness, not your 3-year-old brain. You never actually stepped into a time machine. Hypnosis is the tool I use to help people recall such childhood events, and more. Many of my patients and the people who have attended my workshops are able to remember events not only from their childhood, but also from when they were in their mother's wombs, from that mystical state when they were in between lives, and from past lives. Throughout the years, I have encountered people whose preconceived notions about past life regression therapy have compelled them to dismiss the concept entirely. They argue that the memories are distorted or inaccurate, as I have addressed, or that its therapeutic effects can be ascribed to wishful thinking, or that everyone who has a regression erroneously identifies themselves as a famous historical figure in a past life. Such critics are vocal but misinformed.
We've just heard Miracles Happen by Brian and Amy Weiss. Debbie May Comber taps into the magic of the season with her newest Christmas novel, Dashing Through the Snow. Ashley Davison, a grad student in California, desperately wants to spend the holidays with her family in Seattle. Dashiell Sutherland, a former Army intelligence officer, has a job interview in Seattle and must arrive by December 23rd. Though frantic to book last-minute flights out of San Francisco, both are out of luck. Every flight is full, and there's only one rental car available. Ashley and Dash reluctantly decide to share the car, but neither could anticipate the wild ride ahead. At first, they drive in silence. But, forced into close quarters, Ashley and Dash can't help but open up. Not only do they find they have much in common, there's even a spark of romance in the air. Their feelings catch them off guard. Neither has ever been so excited about a first meeting. But the two are in for more twists and turns along the way. Ashley and Dash may not reach Seattle in time for Christmas, but the season will be full of surprises, and their greatest wishes may yet come true. Allison Ryan performs the book.
Ashley Davidson couldn't believe what she was hearing. The reservation clerk for Highland Airlines glanced up nervously. "I'm sorry, but I can't sell you a ticket to Seattle. If you'd kindly step aside and wait a few minutes..." "Can't? Or won't?" Ashley cut in, growing more frustrated and worried by the minute. She drew in a deep breath in an effort to control her patience. The woman behind the desk, whose name tag identified her as Stephanie, was clearly having a bad day. Getting upset with her, Ashley realized, wasn't going to help the situation. She made a determined effort to lower her voice and remain cool-headed. I can't. I'm sorry. Ashley refused to take no for an answer. Surprising her mother by flying home for Christmas was too important. I understand getting a ticket to Seattle 4 days before Christmas is pushing my luck, she said, doing her best to appear calm and composed. If I'd been able to book a seat sooner, I would have. Getting Christmas off from work was a complete surprise. I attend graduate school, and I also work at a diner. I hated to miss the holidays with my mother, but I didn't have any choice. She's a widow, and my brother lives in Texas and can't get home for Christmas, so there's only me. Perhaps if the reservation clerk knew her story, she might reconsider the can't sell you a ticket part of this discussion. Then my boss decided to close the diner between Christmas and New Year's for renovations after the refrigeration unit broke, and then he thought he may as well get a new deep fryer too, so it just made sense to close down. All this happened at the very last minute, and because he felt so bad, he gave me a Christmas bonus so I could fly home. I'm so sorry, Stephanie said again, looking nervous. If you'd kindly move aside and wait a few minutes. I haven't seen my mother since last August, Ashley continued, refusing to give up easily. I wanted to surprise her. It would mean the world to both of us to be together over the holidays. Would you please look again? I'll take any seat, any time of the day or night. Stephanie didn't so much as glance down at her computer screen with even a pretense of trying to accommodate her. I can't. I wish I could, but I can't. Ashley couldn't help but wonder what was up with this can't business. That made it all the more nonsensical. You can't, she repeated. There must be more of an explanation than that. It just doesn't make sense. The reservation clerk frowned. Her eyes roamed about the area as if she was looking for someone. That, too, was irritating. It was as if she was seeking a replacement or someone to rescue her. I believe you have your answer, the man behind her in line said impatiently. He shifted from one foot to the other, letting Ashley know he didn't appreciate her arguing with the clerk. Ashley whirled around and confronted him face to face. In case anyone forgot to mention it, this is Christmas. How about a little peace on earth and goodwill toward men? Be patient. I'll be finished as soon as possible, and then you can talk to Stephanie, but for now, it's my turn. In response, he rolled his eyes. Ashley returned her attention to the woman at the counter. If you can't find me a seat on a plane to Seattle, I'd be willing to fly standby. Stephanie shook her head. All the flights to Seattle are already booked? The man next in line blurted out the question. Stephanie's eyes widened as if she, too, was surprised he jumped into their conversation. I didn't say that. I'll speak to you directly in just a moment, she said. Excuse me? Ashley flared, forgetting her resolve to remain calm and collected. This was too much. With her hands on her hips, she stared down at the other woman. This is discrimination. Just because he's a man and good-looking, you can dredge up a seat for him, but not for me? This was gender discrimination. Where was a television crew when you needed one? This would make a juicy piece for the 6 o'clock news. Seeing that the line was getting long and the Grinch behind her wasn't the only one with a short fuse, Ashley decided to drop the entire matter. Okay, fine. Have it your way. But I think this is just plain wrong.
That was Dashing Through the Snow by Debbie Maycomber. Have so many wonderfully cherished traditions, and we at the Book Report have ours too. This year, I'm thrilled to share a reading of Clement Clark Moore's beloved Christmas favorite, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," with you. Our guest artist today
"'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap, when out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters, and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave a luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes did appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. With a little old driver, so lively and quick, I knew in a moment he must be Saint Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky, so up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with a sleigh full of toys, and Saint Nicholas too. And then, in a twinkling, I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney Saint Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur, from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled! His dimples, how merry! And his cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed, like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
All of us at The Book Report wish you and yours a magical holiday. Happy holidays from our executive producer, Derek Hewitt.
May Santa bring you all the books your heart desires, and have a wonderful new year.
Our beloved engineer, Steve Johnson.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Studio manager, Ivian Nunez.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Audio producer, Dave Hain.
Merry Christmas, everyone, and I hope you all have a very, very happy new year.
And me. Enjoy every moment, the hustle and bustle, and those quiet, stolen moments where you can actually relax with a great book. Thank you for joining us. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.